quite a lovely Jackson Pollock, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
What does it say to you?
It restates the negativeness of the universe, the hideous, lonely emptiness of existence, nothingness, the predicament of man forced to live in a barren, godless eternity, like a tiny flame flickering in an immense void with nothing but waste, horror, and degradation, forming a useless, bleak straitjacket in a black, absurd cosmos.
What are you doing Saturday night?
Committing suicide.
What about Friday night?
Ah, nothing like Woody Allen for a dose of biting existentialism, coastal nihilism, and the facing of the bleak, absurd cosmos. Nothing like it. And I know Karen Ass Clenchers today would want to cancel me for even quoting Allen. But what is relevant, and I haven't perfected my Kevin Spacey impersonations.
I think you just became my personal hero.
Heck and heckity, the message is pretty Gnostic. Except it omits the part that those tiny flames that constitute man can blaze this black, absurd cosmos into a wonder of meaning and laughter. That Sophia's rescue operation has been succeeding since the universe was molded by her demented son. That those who want to awaken into an expanded, immortal sense of consciousness can do so. And, at the same time, those who love the material world are more than welcome to languish in this black iron prison as recycled meat compost. We have both choice and potential. So choose your Ouroboros fighter well.
Sir, are you classified as human?
Negative. I am a meat popsicle.
Yes, Woody. It is hopeless, as the chick says in the film Play It Again, Sam. But where hope dies, imagination must live. And as the Cheshire Cat told the avatar of Sophia, imagination is the only weapon in the war against reality. In the same vein, it was Colin Wilson who said, imagination should be not to escape reality, but to create it.
Such a disappointment. We can make anything we fancy in this arena of infinite promise. And this is what we come up with? Weapons? War? Surely we have more imagination than that.
So welcome to Aeon Byte, to find and unleash your inner flame, your divine spark, which William Blake equated with nothing more than your untapped imagination. The awakening of any individual is a cosmic event, Clark Emery said, while I say the awakening of any individual is a cosmic rebellion. Your awakening, your expansion of consciousness, is all you need to battle the creator gods and their but slaves in the establishment. It's what will dictate your sacred and profane purpose, allow you to choose ecstasy over entertainment. It's what will help you write your own gospel and live your own myth.
As Hemingway said, there is nothing noble in being superior to your fellow man. True nobility is being superior to your former self.
As always, I am Miguel Connor, your pompous of gnosis, and that voice in the digital wilderness crying out for your inner Prometheus and indwelling Pallas Athena. The two figures who, yes, stole fire from Olympus and gifted each human with that inner flame.
It was a gift from the Titan Prometheus, a gift that he stole. We wield incredible power, the power to transform, to destroy and to create again. The question, of course, before us is what the hell are we supposed to do with this power? Or more importantly, one should ask, what are we allowed to do with this power?
Without a doubt, there is a lot of horror in this black, absurd cosmos. and certainly much confusion in this age of Hermes, where civilization is collapsing under a thousand apocalypses. Many still struggle in understanding evil, suffering, and what in Odin's dingleberries is the supernatural.
He who questions training only trains himself at asking questions.
What?
Worry not, for Aeon Bai continues to pave a way for that middle path between orthodoxy and scientism. This episode is a strong underscore. Materializing at the virtual Alexandria, we again have the infernal pleasure of being joined by Anthony Tyler to discuss his new book, Hunt Manual. The work is preggers with data and philosophy on both supernatural and carnal evil, from demons to serial killers, yet provides nuanced explanations that strike at the heart of Gnosis. In the end, Hunt Manual is a very positive book that helps one do that essential shadow work our culture has abandoned for boot-on-the-face complacency.
Those who would give up essential liberty to purchase a little temporary safety deserve neither liberty nor safety.
A perfect episode to conclude the season of the witch. But please keep facing those shadows and horrors the rest of the darkening months. As Santa Muerte contends, and the ancients believed, true life is found in the womb of death.
I knew a man who once said death smiles at us all. All a man can do is smile back.
The horror of this bleak black cosmos. Evil. I like what Franz Kafka said. Evil is whatever distracts. Simple as that. As the Gnostics explained, the bad shit out there keeps us from looking within to our inner flame. But so can the allegedly good shit. Your money, mobile device, emotions, appetites, and career goals can also sink you into ignorance. The mother of all sin, as the Gospel of Philip states. Sink you just as much as fear, dark spirits, or authoritarian governments.
People should not be afraid of their governments. Governments should be afraid of their people.
In the secret book of John, the Garden of Eden is a hypnotizing chimera impeding Adam and Eve from remembering their celestial origins.
You're just like Adam. He called me and I took one of his ribs and made it into a woman.
You're here to trick me.
Trick you? Why are you trying to save the world? What arrogance to think you can save the world. The world doesn't have to be saved. Save yourself.
Evil is whatever distracts. And play that again, Sam. And again, and again. Don't get distracted. Don't forget, as Jung said, that you came to this world not to be good, but to be yourself, which is a fully awakened and imaginative being brimming with game-changing purpose. Don't be like the meat sacks out there who want power, which, according to Jung, is nothing more than the opposite of good. Orthodox religions ask, how did evil come into the world? Gnosticism asks, how did good come into the world? Simple. It came when you arrived. It exploded as you woke up. For you are the all who, like Adam and Eve, simply forgot.
The divine does not reach out to us from a cosmic beyond. It breathes from within. If the body shells the soul, and the soul is divine ground, then God is earth. God is us. God is all around.
These are indeed Gnostic times, but as I keep saying, eternity hasn't gone anywhere. It's there for your taking because, and as the Gospel of Thomas says, it's both inside and outside of you, spread across the earth. To help you, to give you some sanity hacks, I recently published a short but potent book called 10 Snackable Meditations. Leverage tried and true spiritual / wellness exercises from across the world. Some take minutes to master and renew your mental state for 24 hours. From ancient Buddhism to mystic Islam to modern psychology, find what works for you and only you. The work includes the prison cell meditation from Damien Eccles and Gurdjieff's self-remembering exercise. The feedback has been tremendous. 10 snackable meditations might be the effective toolbox next time your workday goes south. You rumble with your family, or you're stuck in traffic and the Archons whisper in your ear to start giving up. Or maybe you just need an extra Pleroma sauce before your next workout, ritual, or therapy session. And these sometimes feel miles away. Info on the show notes or go to my homepage. Check it out.
If I don't finish my meditation, I tend to get a little cranky. Take care now. Bye-bye then.
Well, I'm shilling a bit. A reminder, I'm offering voiceover services for any commercial, audiobook, podcast, documentary, or even video game that needs some astral audio with down-to-earth professionalism. Let us end with a counterbalance to the Woody Allen intro. It's from the series Midnight Mass, which was simply amazing and reminded me how damn occult the Roman Catholic service is. I've played a lot of clips in my years, as you know, and this might be my favorite one. It's that inspiring and sublime. It's also about 3 minutes long, so if you don't want a quasi-spoiler or want to get on with the interview, skip ahead. But the clip will kindle brighter that inner flame you have that deserves to light all of creation with so much wonder.
I remember that every atom in my body was forged in a star. This matter, this body, is mostly just empty space, after all, and solid matter? It's just energy vibrating very slowly, and there is no me. There never was. The electrons of my body mingle and dance with the electrons of the ground below me and the air. I'm no longer breathing. And I remember. There is no point where any of that ends, and I begin. I remember I am energy, not memory, not self. My name, my personality, my choices all came after me. I was before them and I will be after, and everything else is pictures picked up along the way. Fleeting little dreamlets printed on the tissue of my dying brain. And I am the lightning that jumps between. I am the energy firing the neurons, and I'm returning. Just by remembering, I'm returning home. It's like a drop of water falling back into the ocean, of which it's always been a part. All things, a part. All of us. Apart, you, me, and my little girl, and my mother, and my father, everyone who's ever been, every plant, every animal, every atom, every star, every galaxy, all of it. More galaxies in the universe than grains of sand on the beach, and that's what we're talking about when we say God, the One, the cosmos, and its infinite dreams.
We are the cosmos dreaming of itself. It's simply a dream that I think is my life every time. But I'll forget this. I always do. I always forget my dreams. But now, in the split second, in the moment I remember, the instant I remember, I comprehend everything at once. There is no time. There is no death. Life is a dream. It's a wish. Made again and again and again and again and again and again and on into eternity. And I am all of it. I am everything. I am all. I am that I am.
This is the Aeon Bide interview. And with us, we have the pleasure of being joined back again, as always, by Anthony Tyler, this time to discuss his new book, Hunt Manual. Anthony, thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much for having me back. It's always a pleasure to talk with you both.
Always glad to have you here. We had a great time with our Halloween special last year, and this is sort of a sequel, maybe a prequel, who knows, but good Season of the Witch topics and just good esoteric stuff that you put out. So look forward to having to sharing that gnosis. And with us too, we've got the Moondog, Vance Saatchi. Vance, how are you?
I'm okay. You know, every hunt needs a good dog, so here's the Moondog ready to go.
There you Excellent. Go. And the pun of the day. Awesome. Well, Anthony, tell us about why you decided to write this book. Your first book is Dive Manual. This is Hunt Manual. What's the difference between diving and hunting?
It's a good question. It's a good starting point, too. Well, the general mindset for Dive Manual was everything to do with the divine feminine in many ways. It branches out a little bit, but the divine feminine, definitely the core element. And this Hunt Manual, the core element with this one being the shadow specifically. So everything to do with the shadow, and that immediately becomes a tangled web, but it was a tangled slinky, maybe more precisely. But I had a lot of fun trying to just unknot it a little bit, because it's such a, I mean, if you really want to follow the Jungian shadow to its logical ends, as you know, as we can see it so far from our vantage point, with everything, you know, with it generally representing, you know, the chaotic side of our psyche and that which we don't fully understand yet, but are processing cognitively on some level. Well, long story short, that ultimately, if you're seeing that through to its logical ends, that has to play some sort of role in us understanding unexplainable phenomena. I mean, just really by definition. And I mean, Jung was stabbing at that before, especially at closer to before he died. And, you know, I have in this book, just like Dive Manual, and if anyone's heard me talk, I have like my classic choir of sources in the background. Like I go through a lot of different material, and I have the sources in the bibliography, but my favorites as always are Jung, Manly Hall, John Keel, and this one in Hunt Manual, more so than Dive Manual, I throw good old Jacques Vallée into the mix a bit as well. So, you know, the shadow first and foremost, and what you know, the hunt allegory being, so if the dive is kind of like, you know, the hermetic tradition of the divine feminine sort of being the water and the ocean itself, among other things, this whole shadow complex, the Jungian shadow, you know, being typified by everything we just discussed so far, really seems to I mean, there's no other way to really articulate it than that sort of hunt process. And that's something, you know, it's not summed up easily in just one sentence, because, you know, the vantage points of the hunt get into predator and prey and good and evil and horror. And, you know, like what, like first and foremost, I guess, as a good starting point, like what really is good and evil?
Right.
And, yeah, I mean, that's quite a tangled web. And, you know, to set the stage a little bit, because you really can't talk about you know, demonology or the unexplainable without trying to lasso what evil is.
Yeah, we certainly want to get into all these nuanced topics, Anthony. And I think you hit it on the head, especially when you bring in individuals like Jung and Vallée and Kiel, who are trying to figure not just finances, but I think they're all of them are trying to figure out a middle path, a new language, how we can deal with the unexplainable out there, the other. And your book definitely hits all the high marks when it comes to this. And in Dive Manual, it's more autobiographical. Because you talk about your life and your journey from Alaska to California and all that. This one, it is also about Anthony, but I think you're kind of letting your own shadow have fun, aren't you? Because it sort of starts with this narrative, this cabin in the wood that continues throughout the whole book.
Yeah, absolutely. So kind of following with, like, I guess it's almost like a Socratic dialogue sort of narrative in a way, where I'm talking to the reader throughout. We start out in this classical cabin in the woods, Evil Dead sort of motif, right? And you have amnesia, you don't really know where you are, and the only things that really become quickly obvious are all the dangers around in the wilderness. And you gotta essentially figure out, first you gotta figure out if you're gonna trust me or not, and then you gotta figure out how to navigate your way out of the wilderness, how to get around all the beasts out there, and maybe some of the lunatics that have lost their minds in the wilderness. And so, like, all of that essentially is an allegory, a working allegory for what a Fortean investigator once called the Goblin Universe. That's a good setting stage piece too. Now, for anyone who's not familiar, this is like a really obscure book that very few people have read. I haven't even read it because it was only in print for a short period of time, and it was published. It was a rough draft from a Fortean investigator, Bob Holliday, and it was published posthumously. And it's a rough draft, and it's not, you know, it doesn't have all its T's crossed and things. But it's a really interesting premise, and I think he was the first one to really kind of articulate this unexplainable phenomena correlation to the shadow complex. And he gets into, you know, there's one bit that that the book is kind of like famous for, people still recognize it for, is Bob Holliday and two Catholic priests go out to Loch Ness and attempt to exorcise the lock from Nessie. And I think that that's not quite the right way to go about things, but it's very interesting, and I have a lot of respect for it. Like, and especially because they went out there as an experiment, they weren't really sure it was going to work either. But what they're really getting at is we're going down the rabbit hole real quick. But if archetypes are these biological correlates to the existence, you know, ways we internalize forces of the cosmos, essentially, and memes are the way that we exchange those archetypes, and memes are viral by their nature. Sentience is a different story, and that's kind of each person's own path to decide for themselves. But in terms of autonomy, the viral nature of these things in and of themselves starts to lend credit to the sense of autonomy. And when you start to, you know, because here's the other thing, is like, me personally, I don't think that there has ever been a monster in Loch Ness, but it's very interesting. This whole growing mythology of it, it's been around for so long. And the more you look at, you know, things like cryptozoology, which is, you know, part of the umbrella of Fortiana, you see that the interesting thing, at least to me, and I think to a lot of other people, is not so much whether or not these monsters or animals are real half the time. It's what's going on here. Like, even if they aren't real, there's still something here, like real in the traditional sense, flesh and blood, there's still something going on here. And in terms of the, you know, we've talked about heuristics in the past when I've been on the show with you, and this sort of trial and error education process that birthed the scientific method and empiricism as we know it, but it had its flaws because it is trial and error, and it's using the imagination for trial and error. And you can't take those things literally sometimes, but that doesn't mean you can discount them either. So, I mean, to ground it a little more, Loch Ness is a fun example, but, you know, if we're getting into like really some seriously hard data, because all of Hunt Manual, you know, a lot of the subject matter is actually, if it's not like existentialism, like Jung or Kiel, it's a lot of police reports and stuff. And because, you know, I'm not trying to mince words or anything. I want to get down to, you know, so the closest we can get, because I don't think anyone's going to have the answers to these things, but I think we could definitely draw further comparisons and, you know, just slowly chip away at the unexplainable. I mean, that's the part of the human experience in and of itself. You chip away at it slowly and you find more and more common denominators. And I mean, the common denominator here, if you're the real ultimate starting point and like probably the biggest recurring theme throughout the book, was a notion that kind of grew on me over time as I was just looking through all this different sort of subject matter. And it was a seed that I kind of planted with Dive Manual. And not only is two chapters, the one about actually, I think they might have been the same chapter. Point being, I had two bits in Dive Manual, one about sleep paralysis and one about, right, you know, Ramachandran and the phantoms in the brain and him using basically like mirror trickery to, you know, like legitimately heal people of their phantom limb pains and stuff. And so you get into mirror neurons and the like real heuristic value of the projection process and how the projection process, you know, not just in a philosophical sense, but in a very literal neurological sense, even holds some real underpinnings to like trauma. It's like a gateway to trauma and catharsis. You know, I've heard hypnotists in peer-reviewed studies talk about how hypnosis and the unconscious mind essentially is the gateway or one of the gateways to the nervous system. And I mean, there's a lot of data to show this. And so you look at dreams, you look at things like sleep paralysis, because the science behind sleep paralysis certainly fits in this model. And you look at phantom limb and you look at these other things and you see there's a recurring pattern happening and there's some sort of purgative quality to it. You know, Kiel, he touched on this talking about the Mothman prophecies. It wasn't just the Mothman that he put this prophetic sort of omen quality to. I mean, that was pretty much like Kiel's takeaway to unexplainable phenomena in the long run, was there's some sort of omen quality to this. And, you know, that's something that, you know, Jung, he obviously wasn't trying to get into the like Fortean phenomena too much, because he held, you know, he was a scholar first and foremost. And, but I mean, even he got into UFOs. And if you take his opinions on mythology and UFOs, I mean, you really get the same idea right there. And
right.
Hall was talking about the same thing. And, you know, when it comes to cryptozoology and things, you really can't separate them from mythology to begin with. You're talking about like the viral nature of the meme, and, you know, you take it back to the Loch Ness bit for a minute and you see that, there's something very interesting going on here. There's some sort of, transference, certainly some sort of purgative quality. And, I don't know. I mean, I could keep rambling, but I'd like to give you guys the floor a little bit.
Yeah, no, well said, my friend. You are right in all of this. And I mean, speaking of Jung, it's, and I keep repeating, especially during Halloween, but he talking about UFOs, he said, yes, they are projections, but they are kinetic. In other words, UFOs appear on radars. They right. can be seen. So there's a interactive idea that we're projecting, but we're also dealing with this otherness that's out there. And I know this is, it's nuanced, but your book really tries to understand this, how it's happening. And of course, Kiel with his ideas of the super spectrum and these otherness that's out right. there. And it's almost, there was a book I'm reading by James True, and he has a great chapter on demons. And he says, demons are basically algorithms. We have to be connected to the space to the certain computer system in our lives. And these algorithms, we interact with them and we give them power. We give them code. They give us code. And they can appear in different ways and affect us different ways, especially how we see reality. So it's really fascinating. But maybe to go back, so the audience understands well as we continue, you say heuristic. Maybe could you clarify? Because again, I remember from our last interview, and you mentioned this in this interview too, in Hunt Manual, you talk about the idea that porcupines don't shoot their needles. How is it? Maybe explain more about what is heuristic?
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, the two easy, quick examples would be the porcupine example you just gave. I mean, there's still a lot of people to this day that do think porcupines shoot their quills. And I mean, the general takeaway is, even though that's not a literal truth, you'd fail that answer on the test. If it keeps you further away from porcupines, then you might be better off for it. And, you know, there's a lot, you know, especially if you look at, you know, just human history, there's so many, more than you could ever conceive, examples of heuristic education. And, you know, people thought, like, especially in the medical field, I mean, that's where the medical field comes from. But, you know, another easy example, like, people used to think that you could pick up disease from smell. And I mean, it doesn't really work like that, unless it's like chemical warfare potentially, but it's the same principle. Like, you might stay further away from something that could get you sick. And in the long run, there are a lot of, I mean, this is essentially the definition of mysticism and, you know, religious phenomena. And that's not where the trail of breadcrumbs ends, but you have to take, like, if we're going to understand any of this stuff, we have to understand that the first and biggest common denominator is the human experience. We're all working with the same brains here, even if they might be slightly different. And, you know, that's why I like, you know, like Jungian psychology so much, because it's just looking to be as reductionary as possible, not to keep it there, but to just find a good starting point. And yeah, we really can't progress in certain ways. You know, the scientific method can only get us so far. It can do the things that it's currently doing, and we see that it has these major limitations, just because of its, not because it's imperfect, it's just another tool in the belt. And one thing that you look at, or one thing that you slowly, I don't know, at least dawned on me, especially after writing this book, is that there is definitely an undeniable threshold between the subjective and the objective, there where some lines really get blurred. And I think that that example you gave with James True talking about the algorithms and things, I think that's a really rational way to put it, because I think that if nothing else, there's some serious legitimacy to that. I mean, you could take it as far as you want in your own personal beliefs, but if we're just getting down to the nitty gritty, there are definitely things floating around. Essentially, there's information that we can interact with. And I think, the idea that the unconscious mind and is a gateway to the nervous system, and that we kind of engage with that faucet tap with our states of consciousness, I think that's a major starting point for unexplainable phenomena and the shadow as we know it.
Exactly. And even something that I've said, I've quoted Jung, he said that archetypes are quasi-conscious. They can't have some sort of agency once they, again, like an algorithm, find you and interact with reality for whatever's going on, the cosmic individuation, who knows. But you yourself write too that Jung himself considered the archetypes to be autonomous. They were self-contained and self-directed. So that definitely brings a lot of, it can bring a lot of unexplained things in our lives.
Absolutely. Yeah. And they're certainly autonomous, if nothing else. I mean, good and evil in and of itself, as I try to break down in the book as clearly as possible. I mean, it really seems that just from like an Occam's razor point of view, good and evil doesn't exist on the objective level that some people like to think it does. But to say that it is irrelevant in the human experience is also like equally preposterous. And There's some sort of a living mythology happening, and this gets into the idea, really, so like good and evil being major, I don't know, they're like really resolute fixtures because of the things that I just said there. And so if you kind of like follow that logic through, this really gets us to things like tulpas and egregors. And to me, I think maybe some people might think that might consider this reductionary or something, but I think I've done plenty of legwork in Hunt Manual and even Dive Manual a bit to show that this is definitely part of the equation. The idea that this unexplainable phenomena, I don't think it's purely coming from just like, exclusively from the human psyche, but as Valet said, there's a completion of a circuit happening. It's like if a UFO crashes in the forest and no one's around to see it, does it really crash? I'm not convinced it does, but I don't think that it's it's just a hallucination either. And this gets into other stuff like what I would call, I think this has been used by other people as well, transphysical phenomena. And because I don't know where it comes from. I mean, there's some, in my opinion, it all stems from this, what we're building on with the nervous system and things. But in the long run, I mean, who knows what's really happening there? But when you look at things like the police reports for, I have police reports for poltergeists and some Sasquatch, man. Yeah. And I got
your book is full of data and stories objectively recorded, like you said, by police, eyewitnesses. It's there's something out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. You look at it, only takes one truly unexplainable case to kind of break it open. And when you look at, just, I don't even know how many cases I have in there, but maybe like, because I talk like police reports specifically, there might be up to like 10 police reports of really wild, unexplainable phenomena in there, where just even the skeptic, like you have to be convinced that there's a conspiracy here to sell books or something. And a lot of time that doesn't hold up anyway, even though that is true with the case, like the Amityville Horror, as far as I'm concerned. You got to sift through, you got to separate the wheat from the chaff here, but there's one of the punchiest police reports, just in terms of how interesting it is the Church Street Poltergeist police report that came out of St. Catharines, Canada at the end of the, or in the mid 70s. And I mean, the police officers were investigated that extensively because of complaints from the surrounding neighbors in the apartment complex and like potential child abuse and things, because this kid was getting slung around a room. And the police came, and none of these officers are paranormal enthusiasts. None of this family ever sought anything on public record. They've all stayed away from public record. But I mean, after a 28-day ordeal that ended up getting leaked to the public and, made it into like big nighttime talk shows and stuff as headlines, the police officers say in the police report, like, after all of our investigation and after everything we've witnessed, we have no other explanation, all of us, except for the fact that this child is being affected by a poltergeist. We've seen this kid slung across the room with our own eyes. We've seen things dart all around the room. We've witnessed police officers sitting on couches that levitate for no reason in the household. You can't make this stuff up. And this is, again, in the police report. So, I mean, at a certain point, I think it's good to be skeptical, but then we also have to just kind of, again, no one has all the full answers, but kind of in that classic Fortean tradition, that sort of Charles Fort Book of the Damned, is just like, look, here's evidence, there's something happening. And I mean, that's just the beginning. It gets into all sorts of the serial killers and cult leaders.
We want to get into all of that, because again, your book was just, I couldn't put it down, because you give so many good ideas. And like you said, this reminds me of what Valet once said, is when you're talking about aliens or extraterrestrials, disregard their ontology at your own peril. In other words, if you're in the woods and you see those lights coming, you just ignore them and write them off. See what's going to happen to you, or absolutely, things are moving in your house, or you see the two red eyes in the woods. It's like, no, you're in the hunt. You are being hunted. So, and there's absolutely no way out. Once you're absolutely in, you're in, man.
That's such a great quote too.
Yeah. And just backing up before we continue, you mentioned Goblin Universe. What's a Goblin Universe? David Bowie?
Yeah, I was making that point, and I veered off to the Loch Ness a little bit, but it's good because we've done all the legwork explaining it. The Goblin Universe was the name for what that Fortean investigator that went out to Loch Ness, it's what he called this threshold of the human shadow complex and unexplainable phenomena. So he said that is the Goblin Universe, this sort of etheric dark side that basically encapsulates the hunt, whether you're on one side or the other. And that was not an initial inspiration for me writing this book. And after being done with the first draft and, you know, kind of like sitting on it for a minute, thinking about things, that was when I came across Bob Holliday's book, because I don't think anyone can really find it, not unless you're like a book collector. You could find it on Amazon for like $600. I don't think it's worth that. Yeah, because it's just not many copies. But you could find like a good podcast about it. There's a popular podcast some of your listeners are probably familiar with. Last Podcast on the Left is like Adult Swim sponsor and stuff, but they get really into the horror and esoteric and stuff. So if you're interested in any material in the Goblin Universe book, you could find them. Do a pretty thorough dive into it. But I mean, it's an idea that if it's found anywhere, it's found amongst chaos magicians, it seems, because they seem to be the most receptive to, I mean, like ultimately what I'm kind of stabbing at here is, because I very much appreciate chaos magic, but I also very much appreciate tradition. So I kind of walk that fine line. But I do very much, I think the evidence shows that there are obviously ways of interacting with metaphysics, the physics of the psyche. There are ways of doing that aren't currently like cataloged. You know, not everything is cataloged in the esoteric tradition. And I think that we have, you know, like essentially the building blocks for things, but you know, there's a whole a bunch of different ways to skin a cat. And, you know, I think there's the sense of the fact that unexplainable phenomena seems to follow our, the human experience and kind of reflect our imagination in ways I really don't think that you can understand the full picture without considering that either. Because you know, that doesn't take away from the reality of it, you know, in the ways that we're talking about and the James True algorithms and things. But I think these things certainly aren't flesh and blood in the traditional sense at this point. And you know, if anything, they're very much like the tulpa or the egregor. I don't know if you guys or any of your listeners are familiar with this, but there's are you familiar with the what is it called, tulpamancy and the My Little Pony fandom, the bronies that started developing tulpamancy? This is a
whole... I gotta hear this.
My Little Pony.
Seriously, yeah. So
not Hello Kitty though, right now.
it's pretty wild. This is like, so tulpamancy as a thing being, you know, like the thought forms that we cultivate and create, like put inertia behind, and they eventually become these magical vessels, like proverbial bottles for a genie, essentially. You could put it like that. And but really where this, and this is like a very esoteric tradition, obviously, but where this comes, where this has taken any sort of like mainstream momentum at all, is some years ago, you know, like after 2010 or something, fairly recent, the subreddit of tulpamancy snowballed out of the brony fandom, where just people were, I'm very serious, people were legitimately trying to create very, very legitimate metaphysical beings out of the different characters from the universe. And I don't understand why they would have chosen that of all things. And I think, you know, if anything, I like the example because, you know, I find it a little humorous, but I'm also not going to sit here and say that they're all lunatics. I don't think that. I think that they're probably getting some sort of use out of it, at least on a basic level. And, you know, this kind of gets us into the threshold of the gray area between truly unexplainable phenomena and hysteria. Because, you know, I think that in some way, before we get into hysteria specifically, building up to that, I think that in some ways working with these things, like, you know, this is getting really theoretical here, but if, you know, if people want to hear metaphysics, we're going to get into it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think, you know, especially as far as your audience is concerned, they understand the significance of the tulpa and the egregor. They're not super skeptical about that. So what if, you know, those things are the proverbial bottle for a genie. And what if a lot of these things, you know, in the same way that dreams are, like, they're poignant allegories, you know, even if they seem surreal at times, they might just be poignant allegories from our unconscious mind. And I think that that is probably where it begins. I think that you have to have that fertile ground to start with. And that's where this whole shadow complex and the nervous system and things comes in. But I very much think that after looking at the data and looking at all this crazy head scratching, just where does this physical stuff come from? It's just coming out of nowhere. And there very much seems that I think if you give enough momentum to a thought form, whether it be the singular tulpa, you know, coming from like an individual person, or the egregor being the collective, I think that, you know, you can create the bottle for the genie. And I think that in some cases, things that are probably far more potentially sentient and certainly more powerful than we understand probably work their way into that process.
Oh, no doubt. I think so too. I mean, yeah, there's so many ways we can go at it, but they all start to make sense. And Hunt Manual really tries to put it together. Again, we're talking also shadow projections can easily become tulpa or egregores. And then, of course, you know, your book talks about mental disease. And, you know, if we can have a laughing pandemic, or, you know, mental diseases are contagious, nervous tics, all that. I mean, that's been documented in science. So reality could be a shared mental disease right now that you and I are experiencing in Vance. I mean, that would be completely scientific, because, again, mental diseases can be passed. I mean, you just talk about memes. Richard Dawkins did a lot of great work on that, how ideas are viruses and act like viruses. They can take over like the, you know, like the coronavirus. So there's so many ways we could see it, but again, it's, we're trying to find a new language, a new view of this and everything else. So what do you think, Vance? I mean, you've obviously been a proponent saying very well that math is simply a tool to describe reality. So is science, but it's far from, there are many more tools. What do you think of all of this?
Well, you know, it starts with the question of what's real.
Mm-hmm. Philip K. Dick, it's still there when you stop believing it. Yeah, so that could be.
And, you know, how much do we project? How much is being projected into us? You know, is there, you know, us, all that, that's all, you know, wrapped up in that. But I think another thing more grounded is there ESP? Because if there's ESP, a lot of this stuff is more explainable, you know, as a network of consciousness, conscious beings with the ideas flowing between them, not just in verbal or visual means, but through telepathy. Mm-hmm. And then poltergeist the other way around, you know, that's a short set of thoughts about all this. I could talk a lot more, but that's what I got for right now.
And what do you think of UFOs, extraterrestrials, Vance?
Well, I think that there's many different phenomenon in back of the UFOs. I think there's a reality of some sort out there. Oh, one thing is we all are forced to perceive through our unconscious. Like, you know, it's like none of us is consciously constructing what we see through our eyes, what we hear in our ears. It's all interpretation. And that interpretation happens in the unconscious. So when you see something up in the sky, you can project what you expect. And some people think they're spaceships, and some people think, like in the 1800s, they thought they saw sailing ships up there. They didn't have any concept of spaceships, but now we do. Now we think about spaceships because now, you know, we've created them, so we project that out there. So, but that doesn't mean that they're not there, or that we're making it all up.
Right. Absolutely.
Yeah. So, you know, another thought I had is there within the unconscious, and I just realized this, you know, hearing you guys talk, there's a counter Freudian force in the unconscious. In other words, a reality of not wanting to believe in anything but the common social idea of what reality is. And that is in part of the collective unconscious, the idea of restricting reality to what we can handle, or, you know, because you got to realize people with that believe in magic and whatever, they live in a much more complex universe. There's a lot more threats. People can curse you. People can send their tulpas or egregores after you. And there's a lot more to deal with and to be afraid of, which, you know, kind of brings us to Halloween.
Yeah, well said. Yeah. Well, it's a survival mechanism. I tell my kids, we're safe, believe this, they're going to do it. So the pack can continue. So that is part of it, safety. And of course, your book, Anthony, deals a lot also with chaos, chaos theory, and how there is chaos out there. And do you think part of today's malaise and psychosis is twofold, that maybe we don't want to deal with chaos, Anthony? We certainly don't want to deal with our shadows. Why Halloween is so popular? Because it's a one time out of the year that we can allow chaos and the shadow to come out and have do what it must do.
Yeah, yeah. And that's certainly why it's popular, I would say. And I think that people just don't have a very, they often don't have a healthy relationship with their shadow. And that doesn't seem to be a new thing.
Like on Twitter.
Yeah.
they just throw it out and they don't integrate it. And then it becomes these, talking about egregores, it turns into these weird egregores that are called trending hashtags, you know?
Oh, yeah.
It's bizarre.
It really is. Yeah. it really is. You know, I think the people, one of the biggest, it's not even really a conscious mistake people make, but I think it just, I guess, has to do with some of our cultural programming. It seems that, and I think a lot of this stems from the Abrahamic tradition, where,
yeah, bingo.
Good and evil, you know, evil is associated with wrong. And initially that follows through, you know, like something that, something that is evil might also be wrong, but essentially not everything that's wrong is evil. And a lot of people don't take the time to separate those semantics and really kind of, like, I don't know, let that come to fruition in their minds, because if you do, then it, you know, that's kind of where the whole allegory of the hunt is tied in. It's not, it, like, you could take it as simply as, you know, some sort of Native American ritual and like making sure you don't waste everything. But and you can go into, like, even like cryptozoology from there. But in the long run, it's really just the vantage point from like the difference between, you know, like, where do the tables turn? How do they turn? How do people get caught up in evil things? You know, and how much of people are evil? Is it bred in us? And I mean, I think, you know, along the difference between wrong and evil, like, this is one big takeaway that that I found pondering this concept. And it's, and I mean, it really is just so simple as sometimes when you feel the most self-righteous and, you know, just the like, you're the most justified, that's when we truly become the most evil sometimes. And and, you know, in the moment, it's just a classic part of the human condition. It's almost like antithetical to be worked up with that justification or self-righteousness and, you know, when we're in that moment, we, like, biological hardwiring, don't want to take a step back. We don't feel it's necessary. And, you know, it's also sometimes just as simple as overcompensation. Like, just because you are justified doesn't mean that you're justified to take it to the fullest extent. Because, you know, I could put it like this, you know, just a little cherry on top of that, like, ethical philosophy and stuff. Like, I really, before writing Hunt Manual, I used to say as a joke, like, I think that Batman's the real villain because he won't kill the Joker already. And, you know, there's a little bit of truth to that. You know, I definitely still kind of resonate with that perspective a little bit, but you gun to my head, you know, like, truthfully, I mean, our ethics and our ideals, like, even taking it so far as Platonic ideals and so forth, and this also gets into things like tulpas and egregors or whatnot. I mean, those are really the only things that separate us from the truly mentally ill, because, I mean, collective, the consensus reality is a mental illness, if you want to want to be real about it. I mean, it's like, it's all just this weird fantasy land, this, like, ongoing story arc that people just live instead of writing. And
yeah, 9-to-5 job, the government will take care of us. Love America. Yeah, it's all an interesting delusion.
yeah, absolutely. And I sometimes, the only thing that, you know, some of the only real objective truths, I guess you could say, like, takeaways, is, you know, I do think it's fairly evident that it is, like, not only existentially best and, like, ethically best, but even biologically, you know, just the whole kind of live and let live thing. Like, it makes sense. You don't want to, you know, just, like, let yourself flourish and try to let other people flourish. But there's, you know, there's definitely times where you can't just simply be peaceful. You know, sometimes you got to take up arms, and that adds a whole complication to metaphysics. And, you know, that's, I mean, among other things, that's why martial arts, the philosophy of martial arts, aside from the practice, or in addition to the practice, is really useful. And I think I think people really are not used to what the shadow contains. You know, once they are, they don't do any quote unquote shadow work, they're not used to what their shadow is dealing with, what it holds, because you're never going to have the reins on it, but you can at least develop a rapport with it, so to speak, a rapport with your psyche. And, you know, from there, you can, you know, your shadow can either be like Mephistopheles, you know, leading Faust on his insane and debaucherous quest, or it could be very Virgilian, leading Dante through purgatory and hell. And but the shadow certainly is not inherently evil. And people really want to, I think, unconsciously equate that, and they're really concerned about all these things, and they think that if they do any of that quote unquote shadow work, it's going to be evil without them knowing, or, like, they're going to be tricked, or, you know, all of that is the shadow fucking with you. Like, if you're having those thoughts, you're already in a losing battle, and you really need to, like, stop and assess and think about the ontology of your own thoughts and disposition.
Maybe some people's shadow is actually the nice guy and the good guy, and they're right. In fact, maybe sometimes people's they suppress their good parts because maybe they were hurt by being kind one time, and they learned heuristically that the kindness doesn't pay, and therefore they become ruthless and they get joy out of the power, and so that becomes their normal self, and the shadow is that other part.
Definitely. Yeah. The shadow could be the part of you that you wanted to be a conductor or a politician or a priest, and that got suppressed, and there's that hero still inside of you wanting to come out, and you became you became a lawyer or a journalist, something really unethical.
No, you guys, you really hit the nail on the head, because there are things that, you know, we should, like, vanquish, so to speak, within the shadow. But that's part of the whole discernment. That's why you can't be overzealous or just like fully emboldened with the limitless self-righteousness, because if you just go hacking away, you're going to be indiscriminate, you know, with the good and the bad, that you're trying to, you know, cause there are those like what you would call like the wounded child archetype. You know, those are the things that kind of lurk in the shadow as well. The things that you've abandoned for those, you know, Vance articulated it very well. And that really reminds me of, that feels like a very natural segue into like serial killers and cult leaders, because I think that people's fascination with true crime, myself included, is definitely indicative of shadow work. And, you know, I think that the shadow will find its way out one way or the other. And a lot of people are just, they're able to kind of satiate it through their interests, whether it be true crime or watching horror movies or things. And then sometimes if it becomes really, really something that you really need to process, then you might start having a dream about it. Maybe those are recurring dreams. Maybe you'll start experiencing some sleep paralysis to purge that tension unconsciously. And then maybe, you know, things build up, then you might start experiencing some strange paranormal phenomena. Maybe, and then maybe you might, you know, see a Sasquatch like looking out your window or something, you know? But with the serial killers, we'll start there. That was kind of like, so my dad is, he is about to retire as, a detective for the Anchorage Police Department up in Alaska. And he was he works in financial crimes and things, but, so I've always been interested in true crime, and he actually, he worked a little bit on, some of your audience will have fun, this rabbit hole here. He helped, he was one of the many people who helped break, the case of one of the more notorious serial killers, in modern true crime, Israel Keyes.
Really? Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. Keyes was a guy who, was pretty, unfortunately good at what he did, because he lived in Alaska, right where I was going, at the time where I was going, at the end of middle school, going into high school and things like that. And, he never killed in Alaska, but he would travel, to other states, and he would like, he would go and pick up a car, or rent a car in a different state, and then he'd drive to another state and abduct a person, and then drive to another state and kill them, and then drive to one more state and bury the body. So he was good at covering his tracks. And he also stashed murder kits of cash that he got from bank robberies and lubed up guns that he could just pull out of the ground, like, wow, like buried treasure style, and go on killing sprees, or not technically sprees, but do his murder thing. And so eventually he just, as they all do, they start to slowly lose their minds more and more. And they just get to that point where they don't seem to care at all. They go into like quote unquote berserker mode. And Israel Keyes abducted a coffee barista teenager in Anchorage. And so that was on his home turf, and that really brought the whole house of cards down. And my dad polygraphed the teenage barista he abducted. My dad polygraphed her father and her boyfriend. And he also worked on the tip line with a bunch of other people, you know, talking to psychics and everybody else that had any sort of tip to toss in. And then he also helped, again, as one of many people, because he was, you know, was financial related. Keyes ended up trying to get a ransom, even though he had already killed the girl. And he did get that ransom at first, but something happened with the transaction, and he got screwed and was only able to use an ATM. You can only get like $300 out of an ATM at a time. So they were playing cat and mouse with him, and eventually they caught him through the ATM transactions. But so that's an interesting story right there, because I honestly, I didn't even know that story until a while. My dad doesn't talk too much about his cases or anything. And, but naturally, since my dad's a cop, I have an interest in true crime, and, talking with him about serial killers, he eventually told me that. And after hearing that, it's like, you know, I'm already into esotericism and philosophy and these things. And, you know, it's still, it's like, I want the next book to be about the shadow. So how could I not talk about some true crime in there? It's just a perfect opportunity. And the logic follows. And
Keyes was into Satanism, right?
He absolutely was. Yeah. Not as much as it seems like Richard Ramirez.
He definitely was into the occult. Yeah. But even them, I don't want to be like some fundamentalist Satanism. I mean, there is a commonality with serial killers, and please correct me if I'm wrong or add to it, because I've also read, and they are at a young age, even Bundy had a fucked up childhood. Mm-hmm. Their psyches are broken. They already have some sort of sense. And as their psyches break, I think something comes into them, because many of them hear voices. They had weird relationships. They had paranormal activities. I mean, there is a commonality with these serial killers, right? And then they deal into the occult, and of course that amplifies things, and God knows what comes out and transforms them.
Yeah. That's the thing is, if I'm going to tackle a subject like this, I want to take it as far as I can, but the last thing I want to do is be sensationalist. So I want to be very Occam's razor slicing through all this thing. And, it's real easy to say, to be, get on that fundamentalist high horse and be like, the devil's in them. But, the more you look into it, again, it's just more head scratching material where you're like, hold on a second. What's going on here?
You can put all the pieces, but there's one or two pieces you can never put there. You just
exactly.
Can't,
yeah.
Can't.
And if you want to, go at this, cause a possession, if you want to talk about like demonic possession with serial killers, it's not off the table, but as I frame it in the book, you don't really need, obviously there's a lot of, bullshit that could be tied up in that. So it's easy to get veered off, and that could be like a little bit of a red herring, but it's a red herring because it's never something you can fully take off the table if you're someone that's interested in metaphysics. Even from a metaphysical point of view, you don't really need to get that far. All you need to do is, I mean, if you're just looking at like archetypal demonology and all the legwork that we've put in this conversation so far, like it certainly seems that because of the trauma and the fact that the unconscious mind is again a threshold to the nervous system, and people definitely get to this point where, I mean, just essentially they've decided that however they decide to externalize it, they've decided that they're just going to flip the table. Like it's really, the extents that come from it are very, mind-boggling at times, but the initial premise really is pretty simple. I mean, these people are just so, occasionally you could find just a real psycho, and that's, someone that potentially seems to be born that way. But I mean, there's really no way to know for sure. And, regardless, I mean, even if it's just the vast majority of these people have, I mean, I talk about this in Hunt Manual a little bit. There's like the golden rule is kind of not so much, or not just do unto others as you would have done unto you, but like you will do unto others as you would have done unto you, in like unconsciously, whether you realize it or not. And if you have never been, I think that all humans initially are fairly, I think that we are, it might take some discipline to become like super loving and nurturing, but we're definitely not like it, just evil. And, but you need to be disciplined and, just brought up the right way. You need to, because otherwise, I mean, if you don't have any sort of, ethics instilled in you, then, I mean, how are you supposed to?
Yeah, for example, other people. Yeah, you write about Richard Kuklinski, and I was like floored because I watched a documentary on him, and he was just, he was a hitman who was a serial killer at the same time. But while he was in jail, they talked to him, and the psychiatrist basically said he was born without empathy, and he was a complete psychopath. The difference is, the psychiatrist said, is that he was really abused as a child. So intellectually, his ethics were completely warped. He was like a little kid killing. And he said, if you had been raised right, you would still be a psychopath, but your ethics would have sent you, instead of being a mafia hitman, you would have been a firefighter, a jet pilot, somebody who loved death and violence, but still wouldn't hurt other people, because ethically, mechanically, you would know not to kill other people. You would just been a soldier or something in the front line. So I think you're right exactly about that.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it. And yeah, it really boils down to obsession. You know, some people obsession with the essence of the hunt, because, you know, the hunt is ultimately an inward experience. You know, there are the times of self-defense and, you know, some art of war type action, but, you know, like, that is self-defense. I mean, the real hunt is inward, and the purgative, you know, purification of yourself, searching for gnosis. And I mean, like archetypal demonic obsession, you know, fundamentalism aside, it really is just that pathological obsession with making sure that you are never the victim ever again. And a lot of people have that mentality in their daily lives, and it's one of the worst, most toxic mentalities you could have. But and most people, you know, just kind of leave it in like a state of pessimism and woe is me. But then some people really take it to the extents of the serial killer. And, you know, again, I don't, so, you know, like we talked about evil and dogma and things, like, this is not a, some sort of like overt condemnation of Satanism as a whole, because I don't advocate Satanism per se, but I mean, we've talked about this a little bit in the past. Like, Satanism is not hardly what people on the outside think it is. I mean, most of it is theatrics, getting they're trolls, you know, they're just getting Christians riled up as a joke, and and somehow Christians still haven't figured it out. I don't know how they haven't figured it out. They're the punchline, but anyway, I digress. So that's where I'm coming with this stuff. But even that said, dogma aside, the vantage point of the hunt, if we can see just demonstrably, like even in the historical record, that evil is not like a truly objective thing, you know, you could just see that in the animal kingdom. I really don't think that we can say that these things, you know, these algorithms that we're interlocking with sometimes, I don't think that you can call these things evil either. Are they, sometimes they could very well be evil from our vantage point, but I really don't think at this point that they're any more evil than the lion taking down the antelope. And I think if anything, it's just our due diligence to make sure that we don't get wrapped up in those positions. And if we do, we should be as prepared as we can to deal with it.
We are at the end. Anthony, before we go, where can people find Hunt Manual or more about you?
You can go to my website, divemind.net, and you can find pretty much anything I got going on, whether it be the current chats or interviews I've done. You can find links to Dive Manual and Hunt Manual there. And you can find some excerpts of some written material. You could also, if you want to link up, you can find me on Twitter or Facebook, Anthony Tyler. Pretty easy to find. I got Hunt Manual and Dive Manual in the description, you know, just easy to narrow down. And thank you, anybody, for listening. Thank you guys both so much for having me on. This is a lot of fun. It's fun every time. You guys are awesome.
Oh, no, we really enjoyed it. And Vance, thanks for keeping us company.
Oh, yeah. Don't have to thank me. It was a lot of fun hanging out with Anthony and you, Miguel. So we're ready for the hunt now.
There you go. Yeah, buddy.
All right, Anthony. Always great. And we look forward to our next time.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you and take care.
And there you have it, oh, you shining crazy diamonds. Anthony always brings out shadows for integration. So important. In our second part, Anthony will deconstruct the template of the cult leader. We'll go deeper into the concept of evil and also deconstruct the template of the serial killer and its ties to MKUltra. Then we'll pivot to Jung's answer to Job, to understand both God and Satan as archetypes and forces. Anthony will grant pointers on doing your own shadow work, and we'll cover the phenomena of Bigfoot and UFOs. And yes, we share on some of our favorite recent horror movies, and much more. So please support for the full Shadow Encounter, and it does help grow this Red Pill cafeteria. Only $6.99 a lunar cycle, or whatever you want to pledge on Patreon. You can now subscribe to the easy-to-use private RSS feed from Red Circle. No matter where you subscribe, it will cost you about $1 per episode, and that's a deal of many lifetimes. Membership to AB Prime or Patreon mid-levels includes full access to more than 500 quality shows. You'll get an invitation to the Inner Sanctum of Gnosis Facebook group and my Discord channel. Even support in the form of some shekel donations to PayPal or the US mail really, really helps. There is also a link on the show notes if you want to donate via Stripe now, a tip. I also have the merch store and an Amazon wish list if you want to help there. Finding Hermes is going strong, and so are our virtual Alexandria exclusive private meetings that include exercises loyal to the ancient Gnostics and a monthly intimate Q&A. If you want to understand and experience Gnosticism and its full impact and liberating secrets, become an official citizen of the virtual Alexandria. I've recently done presentations on Abraxas, the Jungian Inner Journey, the secrets of the serpent Gnostics, and why we live in Gnostic times. Whew! I know that's a lot, but I gotta stay spread out as I dodge archons and their projections. I'm also on Rockfin if crypto is your bag. If you need help with all of these choices, just message my ass. I'm always here to help, and I truly appreciate your help. Thanks for being here. Thanks for being yourself, your true self, here in the desert of the real. Hello and goodbye, as always.